Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, from landfills to recycling to what we throw away every day, Sullivan County's solid waste plan is heading to Albany for final approval. We'll hear from Dan Hoos from Sullivan County Government about what's inside the plan. As ICE ramps up deportation efforts nationwide, one man's immigration case is sending ripples through Ulster County. Detained in Kingston, transferred to Buffalo, and now awaiting a hearing, we'll hear from the editor of The Overlook about the story of Antonio Lopez and what comes next. Plus, the latest edition of our local theater podcast, Curtain Call, drops today. We'll get a preview from host Tom Candela. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks opened higher this morning as investors listened to what Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell has to say. NPR's Scott Horsley reports Powell is speaking at this hour to a conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
Investors first want to know what the central bank might do about interest rates when policymakers meet in 3.5 weeks. Markets are betting the Fed will lower its benchmark rate by a quarter percentage point. But we'll get two more key pieces of information before that decision, a readout on both the job market and inflation for the month of August. Powell will also discuss the Fed's long-term strategy for trying to balance its twin goals of promoting stable prices and maximum employment. The central bank's just finished updating that strategy for the first time in 5 years. This is Powell's last address to the Jackson Hole Conference as Fed chair. He and his central bank colleagues have been under intense pressure from President Trump to lower interest rates. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The FBI says it has conducted activity authorized by a court at the home of Ambassador John Bolton. The search is outside Washington, D.C. Bolton was the national security advisor to President Trump in his first term. Bolton is now a fierce Trump critic who has spoken out repeatedly. Trump pulled Bolton's security clearance and his protective detail, even though Bolton has been threatened by Iran's government. The Texas State Senate is poised to pass a congressional map today. It redraws state congressional districts, and it aims to flip 5 Texas Democratic seats in the U.S. House of Representatives to Republican control. California state officials are responding. They'll put a measure to voters this fall that aims to flip 5 Republican seats to Democratic control. U.S. Congressman Pete Aguilar believes California voters will approve the measure.
Symbolically, this is incredibly important. Just as Texas takes 5 seats because Donald Trump says so, California will match that.
Officials in several other states are also considering redistricting. A federal judge in Miami is ordering the shutdown of an immigration detention center in the Florida Everglades. President Trump and state officials call it Alligator Alcatraz. NPR's Greg Allen reports environmental groups sued to block the facility.
Environmental groups filed a lawsuit saying that the hasty construction of the detention center without public input or an environmental impact statement violated federal law. Florida and the Trump administration argued that because it was built by the state, federal law didn't apply. U.S. District Judge Kathleen Williams disagreed, noting that the camp was built at the request of the administration and that all immigration enforcement activities at the camp are under federal control. Quoting an earlier court decision, she said, "If it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and looks like a duck, then it's a duck." Williams ordered all activities at the site to shut down within 60 days. Florida says it's appealing her decision. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
On Wall Street, the Dow's up 650 points. This is NPR. The World Authority on Food Insecurity has declared famine now exists in northern Gaza. The group of experts says over 500,000 Palestinians could die of starvation. Israel rejects the findings of the panel and says it overlooked Israeli data on aid deliveries. The findings come after nearly 2 years of war and Israeli restrictions on aid entering Gaza. Almost 20 years ago, Hurricane Katrina stunned the country. Since this disaster, scientists have made great strides in forecasting and understanding hurricanes. NPR's Alejandra Burunda reports on their progress and how it might stall.
After Katrina, the federal government decided it wanted to make better hurricane forecasts. So it developed a program called the Hurricane Forecast Improvement Project. efforts focused on making better computer models and getting better observations of the storms themselves. And it worked really well. Gabe Vecchi is a scientist at Princeton University.
That was one of those investments in research that paid off.
Forecasts are so much better now, they save the country about $2 billion per hurricane by helping people plan better for the disaster. That's according to the National Bureau of Economic Research. But the Trump administration has cut funding and support for many of the entities involved. And now scientists worry progress could stall. Alejandra Burunda, NPR News.
Meanwhile, Hurricane Erin continues to pull away from North America. It never made landfall, but the storm is so gigantic it's causing dangerous rip currents. There are warnings posted from Florida up to the Canadian border. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR. Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. And joining us on Friday, the 22nd of August, it's Mr. Dan Hoost, who joins us every Friday. He's the communications director from Sullivan County Government with the latest from Monticello. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm doing good.
It's summer again.
Yeah, right. It was briefly winter.
Brief fall winter we had. Now summer. Let's talk about what's going on at the legislature. Lots to get to today. The legislature yesterday approved the final solid waste management plan. We talked about this last week a little bit. Let's remind folks again what this plan is and what's next.
Maps out the next decade, really, of the county's solid waste management. It's required by the state, specifically the Department of Environmental Conservation. Any county engaged in solid waste like we are, which, by the way, is not mandated. A lot of people don't realize that, but
the state doesn't mandate it.
Not for the county to do it. And so, but if the county is doing it, the state does mandate that we have this solid waste management plan in place. So we went through the process. So it's been a good year or more since we've been working on this. The DEC got to see the draft of it. The public did. There were changes incorporated into that. And the final one was voted on by the legislature yesterday. Now it goes back to the DEC for their final review. They've got 30 days to do it. We expect, since we incorporated all the changes they wanted, that they will give it their approval and it will become our actual solid waste management plan to be updated every other year as necessary.
And in that plan, again, as you said, it's the next 10 years of the plan. It addresses some of the issues that the county is facing in terms of waste management, namely where that trash goes. There's no landfill that's active in the county anymore, and the landfill or the trash is trucked up to a landfill in Seneca Meadows, which is undergoing its own review, I understand. And so, how is the county planning for this when there's so many unknowns here with what's the current planning?
I believe our public works has identified a number of other facilities outside of the state to which we could ship trash if Seneca Meadows closes, which is a distinct possibility. We also are petitioning the state to increase our composting, to actually have a full composting facility. We have a composting program, but we ship it over to, I think it's Ulster County. So we're looking at that. And, of course, there's also the legislature is considering a waste-to-energy plant, which would be basically next to the old landfill, the closed landfill in Monticello. But that, just like the composting, is a separate process. It's mentioned in the solid waste management plan because the DEC wants to know what we're thinking about, what we're looking at, what we're considering. But the solid waste management plan does not commit us to anything particular. It just shows the DEC that we are trying to be conscientious about planning for the future. Of course, there are members of the public who feel that a waste to energy plant is not the conscientious choice. There are also members of the public who feel it is. That debate, I think, is going to play out in public with both public comment and the legislature in the months to come, because a request for proposals has been issued and we're waiting to hear back, hopefully for more than one vendor. So, the legislature has some choices to consider. But of course, the choice there too could be not to go forward with a waste to energy plant. That is by no means a done deal in any way, shape, or form.
And that in this
waste management plan that was approved, again, to emphasize again, it wasn't approved to have this waste to energy or incinerator included. It was to study the possibility.
It's just to tell the state and anybody else who's interested that it's under consideration. It does not put anything into place where we are obligated to pursue this course.
And what's the timeline on the request for proposal?
They're waiting to get back. I was trying to find that out today myself. I don't have the exact date, but it should. I would expect it should be within the next month that we should have all the responses back, and then legislators will have a chance to review those and make a decision as to, A, if they want to proceed, and B, if they do, with what company.
Also, there was a decision by DPW to install 4 remotely operated weather stations around the county. What are these weather stations? What do they do? How does that help understand weather conditions in Sullivan County?
Yeah, they call them mini weather stations. I have one at home, actually, a privately purchased one. These are really cool. These are things that can sit out. Like I have it on a post in my yard, and it measures wind speed and direction. It measures rain, how much rain you've gotten just in the past hour, 24 hours, week, month, total. It measures the humidity. It's got a barometer. It even can help predict weather. These do all of that, but they'll also have something mine does not have, actually two things mine does not have, which is constant connection to the internet and also webcams. So that we'll be able actually to look at what the weather conditions are, not just read about it on the dials that it will be showing us on the screen. I don't know if those will be open to the public or available to the public. If they are, I definitely am excited about making that available. But at the very least, it will help our public works teams better assess, especially during the winter, road conditions and general weather conditions, because what the weather is like up in the Roscoe-Tanana Lake area is often not what the weather is like down in the Berryville-Pondetty-Glen Spey area. And same thing with Long Eddy and Calicoon versus Bloomingburg and Wurtsboro.
Right.
It's a county the size of Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. So I was actually surprised we only are getting 4 of these. But then again, at how much are they? At $12,000, I think that's...
Each?
No,
okay.
Total. I think we want to wisely try them out first and see how well that they work. But it will be interesting to see them in operation.
And again, this is for the Department of Public Works to ascertain conditions, to understand road conditions, how to better assess meeting the needs to keep the roads clear. It's not necessarily for weather prediction from the county or those kinds of things. It's just to help.
No, we're not the weather service. We still rely on them. But this will help us be more efficient in the use of taxpayers' funds with both equipment and employees' time as to where we're responding and when we're responding and how we're responding. So the whole idea is not for some extra toy for everyone to play with. People are very busy. This is a tool to make sure that we are deploying the correct resources to the right place at the right time.
Yesterday the legislature unanimously urged the state to enact a law allowing property tax exemption for disabled veterans. Tell us more about this law that's under consideration at the state level.
Yeah, it's both in the Assembly and the Senate. Our legislature urged the state legislature to pass this so that it would establish a real property tax exemption for veterans who have a 100% service-connected disability. So it has to be a disability that occurred because of their service to the country. And the legislature unanimously said, of course, this is something that we should do. It would be exempt from special district charges, assessments, special ad valorem levies, as long as, of course, that they are eligible for this.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Dan Hoost, the communications director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday with an update from the legislature. Other news from the legislature yesterday, they began reviewing applicants for that Charter Review Commission. Let's remind folks what the Charter Review Commission does and the timeline for that. We're up for a review of the charter.
Yeah, just like the U.S. has a constitution, Sullivan County has a charter. It is its document that spells out the basics of government. It was adopted when the new legislature came into being 30 years ago. They succeeded the Board of Supervisors. I'm not exactly sure what the county had prior to that. That's an interesting question that I just asked myself. I'm talking to myself here. So anyway, but the charter mandates that it be reviewed every 10 years, every decade. We are at that 10-year point. So a charter review commission needs to be formed of at least 9 members. It can be more than that, although at this point it seems like legislators are leaning towards 9. We do have 9 letters of interest, but legislators really want to see more than just the bare minimum, because obviously 9, but there's no choice or vetting to be able to be done. They also don't want to do repeats, that I'm told, people who have served before, although I don't know that they won't consider somebody who has served before, especially if nobody else is stepping up. But if people are interested, I encourage them to either give a call to the legislature office, 845-807-0435, that's 807-0435, or to email the clerk of the legislature. That's Annie Martin, and that's Anne Marie, A-N-N-M-A-R-I-E .Martin, at SullivanNY.gov. And we're very interested in hearing from anyone who would be willing to give the time, as is totally volunteer.
And it's open to any community member,
as long as you're a Sullivan County resident.
And what's the time commitment for folks to do the Charter Review Commission work?
I would say realistically that it'll be a year or two before you'd actually finish your work.
Not on a daily basis.
But not on a daily basis. And I'm not even sure necessarily always on a monthly basis. And obviously with 9 folks on the Charter Review Commission, you can miss one or two and still be able to be brought up to speed. But we really are looking for people who are committed to understanding what is the charter. And should anything in it be recommended for amending, which then goes to the legislature to determine whether they really will do that or not.
Right. And then that's all subject to public comment as well.
Oh, yes.
Unanimous agreement to partner with SUNY Sullivan to offer EMT training scholarships, another effort to boost the EMT corps in the county.
Yeah, this is another great thing. This is separate from our Sullivan Promise scholarship, which allows all our local high school graduates to go to SUNY Sullivan and have their entire 2 years of tuition paid.
Yeah, all of it.
It's incredible when you think about it. But the legislature, recognizing the critical need for well-trained emergency medical technicians, that's what EMT stands for, supports initiatives that enhance recruitment, training in emergency medical services, and that includes providing scholarships for students who want to become EMTs. Will provide scholarships at SUNY Sullivan through a New York State Department of Health Emergency Medical Services Sustainability Grant Award. So it actually is not something that local taxpayers are shouldering. It is a state grant that will help pay for this. So we're going to have more to announce about how to apply for this. It just got approved yesterday, so neither we nor SUNY Sullivan has any material to or information to provide yet. But if you are interested, tell SUNY Sullivan. They're the ones to get in touch with about this.
And the SUNY Sullivan budget was adopted unanimously. Remind folks again that the county has a portion that it pays into the operations of SUNY Sullivan.
Yeah, $4.3 million goes towards the SUNY Sullivan budget, which for 2025 to 2026 is $15.5 million. And so the county, because it contributes a significant portion of that budget, has the chance to weigh in on it, both the public and the legislature. That was approved. I don't know if the college itself has officially approved everything. Now, I think it has to go up to the State University of New York system for approval. But basically, I think everything that needed to be done was done. And now they'll have their budget in place and hopefully have a good year full of students and lots of learning.
Let's take a quick break and we'll be back with more from Dan Hoost of Sullivan County Government, including some updates on ag districts and some interns that are making some news themselves. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey there, I'm Jason Dold. You know, we've got a holiday weekend coming up, and you should start it right. So come out to Putt-Putt for Public Radio. This is an evening of mini-golf happening next Friday, August 29th, at Putt-Putt Van Winkle, County Route 6, Bovina Center, New York. We'll have drinks, snacks, everything you need to play mini golf, all for $15, all to support Radio Catskill. That's Putt-Putt for Public Radio, 5 to 7 next Friday in Bovina.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Brunov. Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government is joining us. And the legislature meets Thursdays, most Thursdays. They also include time for public comment. There was some comment on the public comment yesterday.
Yes, there was. Chair Nadia Reich is trying to be more intentional about following Robert's Rules of Order, which do suggest, actually, that limits be placed on the length of public comment. Because, as I know, having been a reporter in a previous life for about 20 years, there are some people who will just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. And business needs to get done. Now, on the other hand, there are people, as somebody said yesterday and said in the past, that spend a lot of time researching and want to share what they have found with legislators, and legislators should be open to listening. The law requires only public comment at the full board meeting, but the legislature actually allows public comment at every committee meeting as well. But what Nadia was trying to do just at her committee meeting yesterday was enforce a 3-minute rule, which, listen, from a public speaker perspective, you're lucky to keep people's attention beyond 3 minutes. Legislators can be sometimes very obvious when their attention is wandering. So trying to be concise actually is a good rule of thumb. And I think the legislature, if it was an important topic, would grant more time. However, what I want to let people know as well is you don't have to wait for a committee or full board meeting to address legislators on something. Obviously, you can write to them, you can email them, you can mail them, you can also give them a call. Many of them have their cell phone numbers. I think all of them actually are welcome calls from the public on their cell phone numbers, or try to see if you can meet them in their office. In fact, in my opinion, one-on-ones are more effective than standing up in front of them to say something to a whole group, because you reach people in a more direct way. And the people who really are the movers and shakers in the community know this already, and they talk to more than one legislator directly, one-on-one, sometimes as much as weekly or more. So if you have something that you want legislators to take action on or to understand or to consider, sure, come to legislature meetings and speak about it there, but also don't neglect talking to them in person. Maybe after the meeting, setting up a meeting with them, finding out what their cell phone number is. You can ask me. I'll let you know what it is. I have no problem with that, because I'm all about people interacting with their elected officials, and not just in the formal official sense, but in the one-on-one sense that, listen, this is Sullivan County, as big a county as it is geographically. It's very small in population. There's no reason you can't be interacting directly and personally with your legislator on a consistent basis. And the ones that really want to serve the public will welcome that.
And probably for longer than 3 minutes.
Yes. I know many who usually get stopped for about an hour or more. But listen, this is what we elected them to do.
Well, some of them are chatty, too.
Yes, they can be as well. And you might strike up a nice friendship, too. Who knows?
Let's talk about those agricultural districts in the county. And talk to folks about how they protect farmland and what they do.
Well, we actually have an agricultural and farmland protection board, and this doesn't necessarily result in any kind of tax discount per se. It's preserving the agricultural and farmland that we already have. This is, of course, completely up to the owners of those property. We don't force that to happen, but we actually had 3 different parcels that were yesterday approved by the legislature to be put into what are already quite large agricultural districts that we have. We have 2 of them. I don't know why we have one called number 1 and another one called number 4. There's no number 2 or number 3. I've never understood that, but okay, that's how it is. And number 1's more sort of the western, northwestern part of the county. Number 4 is more of the eastern, southeastern part of the county. But this Agricultural and Farmland Protection Board reviews every year parcels to be included, which will protect those properties, possibly separately result in some sort of tax benefit. But really, it is about making sure that farmers continue to be able to farm and use those parcels. You don't have to be a farmer to, if you own the property, though. Mm-hmm. You may be like I do. I actually have a farmer on property upstate who I don't even charge him anything. He just comes and hays the property. But it allows open space, which we all treasure and cherish, to be preserved. And the legislature usually just simply accepts what the Agricultural and Farmland Protection Board says, and it passes right through. And that's what happened yesterday.
Last week we talked about how it was the end of some of our internships, our interns going back to school or getting ready to go back to school, and a few of the Sullivan County government interns on their way out the door made some news.
Yes, they did. So
good news.
Yes, very good news. So we had two college interns in the district attorney's office, and I shot a video interviewing them. It's about a 9-minute video that they explain why they enjoyed working in the district attorney's office, what they learned, and why others should be involved in it. And it includes information on how, if people are interested in interning with us, they can. These guys, though, were college interns getting college credit. The other one I want to talk about is a 15-year-old Tri-Valley High School student, Chris Prusalis, who is working in our treasurer's office. He's actually also been in our office for the aging, probably veterans and elsewhere. And he's not getting, to my knowledge, college credit for it, but it was a summer job for him, one he'll never forget. And he brought his own game to what we had going on. He has started a new project called the Blessing Bags Project, which he presented to the legislature last week, which will have him collecting bags of resources for the Federation for the Homeless, you know, toiletries, food, health supplies, to be donated to the Federation for people who are homeless in the community. And he's put collection boxes in his neck of the woods and also in the government center in the treasurer's office. And I was just so impressed to hear him and see him get up, a 15-year-old, yeah, get up in front of all these people and explain what he's doing to help other people. Maybe I don't give teenagers enough credit, and I should more often, but it was wonderful to see. It is on video if you want to see it at sullivanny.gov. We are proud to have these kinds of people, young people, interning with us, and we hope maybe to keep them when they get into their adult careers.
Great story. I want to remind folks that International Overdose Awareness Today, the vigil in Sullivan County, is coming up Tuesday evening.
Yes, and it looks like, from what I think I will be live streaming it on the county's Facebook page so that you can see it, even if you can't make it. I may have very tired arms by the time that's all done, because those things are incredible, and they go for, I think it goes for about 2 hours.
You can borrow a tripod.
I have a tripod, okay, but I also want to move around. Oh, I want to give people close-up views of different things. I think there'll be various things to see and do at this event.
What about a helmet cam?
There we go. Yeah, you'd take a picture of me and post that. You would. Uh-huh. It'd be just as shiny as my regular head. So so anyway, though, that's coming up this Tuesday, 6 p.m. on the lawn of the county courthouse in Monticello. And like I said, if you can't make it in person, I will be shooting video, and you can watch whatever parts you want or the whole thing.
And before we go, we want to say a big happy birthday to Loretta Saltzman, celebrating 105 years. The county celebrated her as well.
It is absolutely unbelievable. I think I'm old when I just turned 50 this year. And I'm like, well, if I live that long, I haven't even lived half my life yet. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, she is a wonderful lady, still very much interested in talking about her life and her history. She lives over in Liberty. And we the legislature gave her a certificate of special recognition, which I think was the least we could do. Some people also brought cake, which was even better. And I took some photos, put that out on social media, and we just wanted to wish Loretta a wonderful, happy birthday. We are so glad she is part of our neighborhood.
Happy birthday, Loretta. And that's all for today's segment. Dan Hoost, thanks for joining us. I hope you have a great weekend.
I hope you do, too.
We'll see you next Friday.
Take care.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, he's lived in the U.S. for more than 30 years, built a business, and raised a family. Now, Antonio Lopez faces deportation. We'll explain why. Next, this is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
On the TED Radio Hour, clinical psychologists John and Julie Gottman are marriage experts. And after studying thousands of couples, they have found...
couples who were successful had a really different way of talking to one another when there was a disagreement or a conflict.
How to be brave in our relationships. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Antonio Lopez is a 52-year-old Ulster County business owner who was detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement earlier this month after a routine immigration interview in Kingston. Lopez has lived in the U.S. since the early 1990s and runs Lopez Construction and Landscaping. He's now awaiting a hearing later this month that will determine whether he can remain in the country. To help us understand what happened and what it means for his family, his business, and the wider community, we're joined by the Overlook's editor-in-chief, Noah Eckstein, who has been reporting on this case. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Tim. Good morning.
And we want to better understand what happened to Antonio Lopez. He's a longtime local resident. He's a business owner detained by ICE earlier this month. Can you walk us through the timeline of what happened with him earlier this month in Kingston?
Yeah, so Antonio Lopez, he runs a construction and landscaping business in Boyceville, which is a hamlet of Olive. He's lived in the area since the early 90s. Earlier this month, he went into what was supposed to be a routine immigration interview in Kingston with his ex-wife, and he never came out, you know. He was detained by ICE and transferred to a detention center in Buffalo. His cousin, Abril Lazaro, says that Lopez has no deportation or reentry violations on record, only that he's undocumented. And she believes his ex-wife's decision to withdraw her petition for him to stay in the U.S., a move she says was tied to personal disputes, opened the door for his arrest. Local officials have said they weren't involved. The town supervisor of Olive said they did not collaborate with ICE on this. His hearing is scheduled for August 28th when a judge will decide whether he'll be deported. You know, his case is one of many playing out quietly across our region that illuminates how national immigration policy can reshape the lives of locals and business owners almost overnight. And I think a lot of our readers, you know, reading regional news, national news, were wondering when this was going to hit our rural local towns. And now it has.
And it's here. You spoke to Antonio Lopez. What is he saying?
No, I have not spoke to Antonio yet. You know, I just spoke to his cousin who is handling sort of his business right now and his family life. I'm planning on speaking with him next week. He can only make calls out of the facility that he's being held in. But this is, you know, sort of a traumatic, tragic episode for him and his family. You know, he's known a lot of his life here in Olive. He was born in Mexico and he is an undocumented immigrant. But we'll see next week. We're going to be closely following the story to see what happens on the 28th.
Yeah, where is he being held now?
In Buffalo.
He's in Buffalo. And how has this detention affected his family, his business, clients? Have you heard from reaction from neighbors or local leaders or immigrant rights advocates in Ulster County about the case?
You know, I spoke to some of his clients who did not want to speak on the record. I think there's a bit of fear going on in the community about speaking out on something like this. People are just shocked that this has happened. But, you know, on background, people are very upset. He was a landscaper. People knew him in the community. He did landscaping for the Olive Library. And I'll be speaking with the librarians next week about how this is just impacting, you know, rurality in Olive.
Yeah, and you mentioned that these detentions and immigration raids from ICE are occurring in the region. There's another case you mentioned, another landscaper.
Yes, that was in Rhinebeck. He was a Rhinebeck High School graduate who was detained and I believe is in the process of being deported.
And the detention fits into this larger trend of immigration enforcement under the Trump administration. And are local officials saying more about that in terms of not just these cases, but just the larger aspect of these ICE raids and immigration detentions?
Not much. I mean, what they're saying is that, you know, Jim Franco, who's the Olive Town supervisor, he said that local officials were not involved in this detention. You know, he said that the highest priority for the town is to keep residents safe, but he added that the town follows guidance from the state and the sheriff's office and does not take part in immigration enforcement unless there is an arrest warrant for an individual. So there's no active collaboration with ICE in these situations, but largely what I'm hearing from, you know, the county and the town is that this is a federal matter that's completely out of their hands and is, you know, the jurisdiction of ICE.
And you mentioned there's a hearing coming up that's set for August 28th, and we'll be certain to connect with you and follow up on that, see what happens with Antonio at the his hearing coming up on the 28th. But I want to also mention before we go a follow-up to a story we spoke to you about last time, which is the convicted sex offender in the Woodstock and how that is playing out. Apparently, there's some new information there.
So that story is actually kind of on the back burner. You know, Anello is reinstated. We spoke 2 weeks ago, so there is some news there. Anello was reinstated on the town roster and is working for the town back as a maintenance worker. So when we last spoke, it was Bennett Ray Clift and Anula Cortez. Anula is the presumptive Democratic. She's the Democratic nominee for supervisor. She's the presumptive, candidate who's going to replace Bill McKenna in the new year. They signed a personnel change order form from Ulster County that terminated Anello's employment. But per Anello's contract with a union, McKenna, there was a grievance filed, and McKenna went to Ulster County with that grievance, and he was reinstated in the town roster. He's now back on the payroll. I've heard from members of the community that he was, seen near the summer camp again, which is not a violation of his parole necessarily, but it's raised deep concern in the community in terms of, you know, McKenna's communication with the rest of the town board and him just doing things by himself as that sole leader.
Yeah, and we're talking about Michael Anello, who was originally terminated and now apparently reinstated. Is this a temporary thing, or how is this playing out?
From what I'm hearing from other supervisors is that they're weighing their options on what to do next. I mean, these town board meetings are in Woodstock are like nothing I've ever seen before, Tim. They are contentious. Mm-hmm. They are people from the community. It's packed. People are yelling, are screaming. People want answers, and people want town government and particularly McKenna to be more transparent in his communication. And it's just not happening. And an example of his communication style, you know, yesterday in Woodstock, there was a cutting down of a 125-year-old silver maple tree on Tinker Street. It might sound like a small town story, but it's really touched a nerve. Supervisor Bill McKenna says the tree had to go because it was a liability to the business owner. Branches had already fallen, nearly hitting a pedestrian and knocking out power. That cost tens of thousands of dollars to repair. But critics, including the tree committee in Woodstock, say that the maple wasn't in immediate danger and could have been saved. So the deeper issue and how this is connected to the Michael Anello story is that the tree committee is arguing that McKenna did not communicate with them and follow the protocols of the town to get a tree, a historic old tree, removed. So it's just a government breakdown is going on. You know, bills are not being paid. We're not being paid. It's just complete government and communication breakdown in Woodstock at this moment.
A lot of attention there on town supervisor Bill McKenna and this singular leadership style, I guess he has.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, it feels like a working out of national politics on the very, very local level.
That's Noah Eckstein from The Overlook. That's the community journalism serving Hunter, Hurley, Olive, Socrates, Shandaken, and Woodstock. You can read more about their coverage at theoverlooknews.com. Noah, thank you for keeping up on all this, and we'll follow up with you in a few weeks. Thanks.
Thanks, Tim. Always a pleasure. Take care.
And we'll take a before we take a break, actually, we want to talk about the New York State Fair and how state officials say they have strict rules in place meant to protect undocumented immigrants who may be visiting the New York State Fair. As Ellen Abbott with the New York Public News Network reports, there are rules regarding federal immigration officials potentially arresting and detaining visitors at the fair.
State Fair Director Julie Lefebvre says the issue of potential ICE raids on the state fairgrounds is something that's come up in the planning stages for the fair.
We have pre-safety meetings all 11 months of the year leading up to the fair, so we talk about any topic that we think could be a concern, and that is included in that.
Lefebvre says the fair closely follows a state policy regarding ICE agents. It's something that's been on its website since 2019. If any federal immigration authority comes to the fair's property, they must first check in at the State Fair Administration Building. From there, Governor Kathy Hochul says a statewide policy kicks in to protect anyone on the grounds.
We have very strong protocols on our expectations. If an ICE agent arrives here, they have to show identification. They have to have a warrant or a civil arrest record.
There are a number of cultural events at the fair every year that draw from the new American community, including a naturalization ceremony. In Syracuse, I'm Ellen Abbott for the New York Public News Network.
And we'll take a quick break now. And when we come back, the latest episode of Curtain Call. Tom Candela joins us next with a preview. This is Radio Chatskill.
Congress has approved a White House request to eliminate federal funding for public media. NPR and this station remain committed to informing the public, increasing your understanding of the world, and enriching everyday life. But without federal funding, we are relying on your support now more than ever. Please make your gift to this station today. Here's how, and thank you.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
This week on This American Life, a man and his car.
You know, like some people also like use the pronoun it for the car. I use the pronoun she for her. Like, and people say you are in a relationship with this car. So.
In the small community where he lives, this guy Ali has the only car, making him the unofficial taxi driver, delivery guy, and school bus driver. So what happens when his car makes an enemy?
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Every Friday, there's a new episode of Curtain Call. That's our local theater podcast, and it's hosted and produced by none other than Tom Candela,
yes,
who joins us now. Hello.
Good morning. Good morning once again.
What's the preview we're going to have for today's episode of Curtain Call?
This is really a good one. You know, back in, it was probably early June, my wife and I went down to the Parlor in Narrowsburg. We saw a performance by Ellie J, also known as Clown Daddy. I had never seen it perform before. It was my first time, and I was totally blown away by her performance. I went right up to her after the performance, and I said, "You must be on Curtain Call," and she agreed. And she performs, as I said, she's also known as Cloud Daddy. She is an actress. She is a mime. She is a puppeteer, and she blends all these things in a one-woman show, Hamlet. She plays all the roles, including a couple of characters of her puppetry characters, but she was really great, and I brought her in, and we had a great sit-down conversation.
And it's something she does for like all ages as well, right? Like,
absolutely.
I know she does some things that are targeted in more adult things sometimes, but there's a general sort of all-ages aspect to this particular production.
Yes, and
this
it's a different type of clowning that we – it's not a bozo clown or a party
she's
clown
not getting
that we're
out of
talking
car.
About. Yeah, she's clowning, but it has a lot to do with movement. It has a lot to do with music. It has a lot to do with puppetry and mime, as I said, and she really is wonderful.
And she studied in France, I believe.
Lecoq, I believe it's called, in France. For 1 year, she studied their movement. And she talks about that in the podcast, about how they studied the movement of everything from a table. She goes, you know, tables move. And I go, all right.
They do in France. In addition to this, we have a little excerpt at the end here.
The Roving Thespian. Yes. I went out to see one of the final performances of Catskill Public Theater's
Woodstock Ripples. And when I say final performance, I mean for this season. Mm-hmm. They will continue next season. And it was absolutely great. Good music, good photos, videos there. And also they had these little one-act plays, or I should say vignettes. And I spoke with a couple of the playwrights of that show. It was great.
All right. Well, this is an excerpt of the latest episode of Curtain Call. We'll hear the roving thespian at the end.
Yes.
But first,
stay tuned.
We're here from Clown Daddy. Thanks, Tom.
Today, we're going to meet a performer who dares to blur the line between comedy and catharsis. Her work is bold, physical, and delightfully unpredictable. She invites audiences to laugh, to reflect, and sometimes even feel a little bit uncomfortable in the best possible way, though. So I want to introduce L.A.J., also known as Clown Daddy. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Curtain Call.
Thank you so much, Tom. That was a beautiful introduction.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay.
For our audience members who don't know Clown Daddy, who is she? Where did she come from?
Well, first and foremost, I've always been an actress. That is how I started out. When it comes to the theater, it's just always been in my bones. So I went to NYU. I went and studied at Tisch School of the Arts,
yes.
Atlantic Theater Company. Mm-hmm. That's where I got that really important sense of technique, because when it comes to artistry, you got to have your foundation. Mm-hmm. But then at some point, once you've got your technique down, you start to feel your wings unfurl and be like, okay, now that I have the cornerstone set, what do I, as a unique artist, really want to be doing? And I noticed how I wanted the physicality of the character. And Atlantic, they're like, okay, our method doesn't necessarily really include the physicality of the character. Have you heard of the Lecoq School in Paris? Mm-hmm. Jacques Lecoq in Paris. Jacques Lecoq was the man who developed the method. And so I moved there and immediately went into Lecoq, and it was, I describe it as the Hogwarts for the actor, because their focus is the dynamics of movement. And so we would study everything, because everything does move. We would study colors. We would study the elements. How do you stand on a stage in a quote unquote neutral way and give and produce that story in your body, where you are, what you're doing, what time it is, what are the elements surrounding you. It was terrifying and very hard. But the dynamics of movement, all of that stuff that I learned in the first year, it fed into who became Clown Daddy. The work that I do is completely rooted in the archetypal clown. Because even back in when I was studying at NYU, one of the elective courses that I took that absolutely changed my life entirely was Per Bra's mask class. And Per Bra had these masks that were all created surrounding the archetypes. And he taught the archetypes like a clock. So the king would be 12 o'clock. And then next to him, the 1 o'clock would be the queen archetype. And then the 11 o'clock was the clown archetype. And I found that very beautiful. Like the clown comes in at the 11th hour sort of thing. The clown is always next to the traditionally, historically, the jester is the one next to the king, whispering in his ear, like, remember, you're also going to die.
Yeah.
You know, the jester, the fool. And so that is the work that I do, is the archetypal laughter maker, because the clown in itself, in its most raw form, the archetypal clown is the laughter maker, the one that brings neutrality amongst all people, places, races, cultures, creeds, everything, and brings them back to the same spot of, I can make you all laugh.
Okay. Eventually, you decided to perform solo.
Mm-hmm.
So where, how did that come about?
I, through trial and error, was like, I don't really want to, respect to everyone involved, I don't really want to be working with people. It's because you want to, at the end of the day, one would hope that everyone's highest intention is to put on a great show, but egos can get involved. And so I was like, with all due respect, I'm going to back away from working with people and see what I can do by myself. And then I moved out towards Calicoon area. I met Tanis, the incredible woman who is in charge of the whole Farm Arts Collective. Mm-hmm. And so it was just through magnificent happenstances that I started involving myself in other theaters and other companies and things like that. So as I was still kind of cocooning in myself as a performer, as Clown Daddy, at the same time, there were people seeking me out. I got to the point where people were like, oh, I've heard of you. Do you want to do this thing? Not necessarily clowning, but you want to be involved in this project. And I'm like, great.
Sure.
So that's how it happened. The other things that kind of come with the people are, oh, you're a clown. Do you juggle? Do you unicycle? Blah, blah, blah. So I've got object manipulation. There's a little bit of magic in there. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't call myself a magician, but there's music as well. So all of these components that I'm kind of like literally juggling, I'm like, okay, well, what fits where? And so that's how I would say Hamlet came to be, because I was able to take all of these skills and go, great, now I can take one of the most famous pieces of all time and take it and really chomp on it with my acting chops, and also add the frivolity and chaos that clowning and puppetry can often bring with them.
So you are playing every single one of the characters that is in the famous play Hamlet. Tell us about what inspired you to take on the bard to begin with.
I'm such a nerd for theater, Tom. I mean, that's like at the end of the day, it's like I love words. I've always loved Shakespeare. 6 months ago, I was offered, literally Hamlet came, my Hamlet all by myself came to being because the illustrious Kathy Geary, one of my dearest friends and biggest fans, yep.
Host of one of our shows.
A host of one of your shows. Yep. With gorgeous voice. She was in charge of the Arts Nest at Delaware Valley Opera. And she was in charge of filling
talent.
Talent.
Yeah.
So I had performed at Arts Nest before, and she asked me to do it again. And I was like, okay, well, I've already done the vaudevillian stuff. Like, I'm kind of sick of doing that at this point. Like, I'll do that later. But I was like, what do I really want to do now? And I was like, God, I would love to do some Shakespeare. Mm. And then I was like, well, why not? You're all by yourself. So I was like, okay, great. I'll do Shakespeare. And then I was like, okay, well, what do I do? And I've always loved the absolute audacity of solo performers. And so I thought, you know what? I'm going to do Hamlet.
If we wanted to catch some of your shows or find out what's happening in your life, in your career, how do we find that out?
Yeah. If people go to clowndaddypresents.com, you'll find everything that I'm up to, that I have done, that I will do. And it also has links to calendar and my Instagram.
Great. There's also some YouTube videos out there that people could watch some of your whole shows that are out there. All right. So give that website one more time so we have that.
ClownDaddyPresents.com.
And what an inspiring conversation that was. I want to thank you once again, Clown Daddy, for joining me today and sharing your journey. And now I'm going to shift gears for a bit, because as part of Curtain Call, I also like to step out of the studio and into the audience, if you will. So this past weekend, the roving thespian, that's me, made his way to Narrowsburg, New York, to catch the Catskill Public Theater's final production of this season, of Woodstock Ripples. And let me tell you, it was a lot of fun. And it really captured the spirit of an era. Woodstock was all about Woodstock. And we got to see photographs that had never been seen before. We got to see videos that we had never seen before. And of course, we listened to some really, really good music. But a special treat was the little plays that they put on, these little vignettes. And I got the opportunity to speak with a couple of the playwrights. It was a really good time. So let's have a listen. We're here at the Woodstock Ripples Part 1 over in Narrowsburg, New York. We saw great performances today, not only of music, but also of some plays. And we have some of the playwrights standing with me right now. Can you give me your name, please?
Stephanie Griffin.
Stephanie Griffin.
Noreen McKenna.
All right. So tell us, ladies, what was the process for getting your writing into the show?
Well, they were requesting work about Woodstock. And Noreen and I went to Woodstock together. So I approached her and said, would you like to kind of just work together and just basically use our joint knowledge and memories? So I wrote a structure, and then Noreen and I filled it in.
And it was a wonderful piece because it's two women who had been there at the actual concert, going back in time and telling about the miracles that occurred for them in that short window of time that they spent there. And what was your contribution to that?
I drove the 60 Chevy. Yes, I did.
That started, and that was miracle number one,
yes,
right?
It was, and that it stopped was miracle number two. Well, I had a pretty good memory of what happened, so I filled in some details. And, you know, I did some color commentary in the process of the writing. And then we just kept working on it and working on it.
I bet it brought back a lot of fine, fine memories, yes, as you were going through it.
That's something I could never have wished for. I've been writing things for many years, and the idea that the two of us, someone you love and care for and have had in your life, works with you on it, and it comes to fruition, and then it gets to be done, was just magnificent. And, you know, it was a wonderful way to remember, to bring it to life in art.
And revitalized, I would imagine. I mean, just to go back to those days again,
yes,
when you two are young girls and going out in life and sort of saying, well, we don't know where we're going, what we're going to see, but here we go.
That's right. That was exactly what it was. And I think the spirit of the piece was really true.
You know, you two are part of history, really. And those two gals, I think, portrayed you very well.
They were so great. They were really good.
So you submitted the play, and then you wait, right? How long did it take before you finally heard something and you were selected?
You know what? In all honest, Tom, can I tell you? Yeah. No idea. And I'll tell you why. Because as a playwright, you are always submitting something.
I think it was about 6 weeks.
Was it?
I think it was about 6 weeks, maybe four, but it was a while. And we were both really shocked.
Was tonight your first time seeing the performance? And what did you think overall?
I loved it.
I sat there, this won't come across on radio, but I sat there like, my jaw was down to here because I couldn't believe how they had transformed what had been written like into a really terrific playlet. They really did an incredible job.
And they did a fantastic job with it.
Kathy and Mary did such a wonderful, wonderful job. They brought it to life, and they brought that moment to life for us.
And to think that 56 years ago today, you two were getting into a car, not knowing really where you were going. And here you are 56 years later celebrating that day. How does that make you feel?
I feel blessed. I've had a very rich life, a very artistic life, a life full of people I love and family and friends. And I don't say it was the magic of Woodstock, but it's certainly, you know, I could have been a housewife in Queens my whole life.
Well, it touched you for your whole life. Well, I want to thank you both ladies for being part of Curtain Call.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And thanks to Tom Candello for that excerpt of the latest episode of Curtain Call, our local theater podcast. You can find the full episode and past episodes at our website, wjffradio.org. Just go to the shows tab there on the navigation bar and then click podcast. You'll find it there along with other podcasts that we have, including the Kingfisher Project, our ongoing commitment to spotlight the impact of the opioid crisis on our community, and a new podcast, Woodstock Lost and Found, uncovering the hidden and forgotten stories of the 1969 Woodstock Festival in Bethel, New York. All of it there at wjffradio.org. Not behind a paywall. Don't need a subscription. Just click and listen. And thanks for your support. Thanks for listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Have a great weekend.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Knock, knock, it's me, Meg Wolitzer. The novelist next door?
Don't let me intrude. I just wanted to bring over this bundt cake and invite you to this week's Selected Shorts, which is all about neighbors. Together, maybe we'll find out why the heck someone might leave up their holiday light display through June. Don't miss it.
Sunday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, sunny and pleasant, high 77. Clear tonight, low 54. And for the weekend, sunny and nice, 78 tomorrow. And for Sunday, 70, not as warm, but maybe also a afternoon thunderstorm, stray thunderstorm possible into the evening as well. It's 11 o'clock.